In this week's programme, Terror in Ireland between 1916 and 1923, from the Easter Rising to the Civil War. David Fitzpatrick, who's Professor of Modern History at Trinity College Dublin, has assembled for publication by Lilliput Press various contributions from the Trinity History Workshop of November 2010, included our essays by faculty, graduate students and undergraduates. The essays range from the sack of Balbriggan to the ambush at Kilmichael to identifying the dead of Bloody Sunday morning. The volume is devoted to the memory of the late Peter Hart, a prominent member of the History Workshop. With me, two of our foremost historians, Ronan Fanning, Professor Emeritus of Modern History at UCD, and Dr. Martin Manser, a former government advisor on Northern Ireland, who served as a junior minister in the last government. Ronan, what did you make of this collection of essays?
I think it's very interesting. I think some of the individual essays are very fine. I'd pick out perhaps the one by Eve Morrison on the Kilmichael ambush, which seemed to be a very dispassionate account of an incident which has generated more heat than light in recent years. And I thought that Jane Leonard's article on Bloody Sunday. But my difficulty with the book, actually, is in a way the concept, and in particular the title, Terror in Ireland. It seems to me there's something pejorative about the word terrorist. Now, they're talking about different kinds of violence. I think it's very interesting. Fergal McGarry's essay, which is a fine essay on 1916.
16, yes.
That, he uses the term violence.
Yes.
Rather than terror.
That's right. The essay is called Violence and the Easter Rising. Yes.
Violence and the Easter Rising. And if you look at David Fitzpatrick's introduction, which is very interesting, he speaks about working definitions. He says terror, apart from being a state of mind, may be defined as a conscious attempt to create an acute fear of violence against the person or property, which may affect individuals, groups, or the population at large. Terrorists are those who perpetrate any form of terror for any purpose. Terrorism implies a sustained and systematic attempt to generate terror. Now, it seems to me this is so broad that it becomes almost meaningless or unhelpful. And, for example, in the essay on prison violence, the author of that says prison violence may justly be categorized as a form of systematic and preconcerted terror against the British garrison in Ireland. Now, it seems to me that it's so elastic that it's unhelpful.
How about that question, the need for greater precision in terminology, Martin? What do you...
Well, I'd have to say, and this may come as a disappointment to you as a presenter, my reaction to the book is almost exactly as described by Roland Fanning.
You thought I was looking for a row, did you?
A compliment. I have noticed this increasingly, particularly at sort of conferences I attend and also publications I read, is the notion of having both established historians and research students contributing to a conference which is then subsequently published in a volume. And needless to say, young researchers, as has been pointed out by Ronan, they can come up with very interesting findings because they focused in on a particular subject in a way that hasn't been focused before. But equally, I do think there is a kind of, which I regret a bit, an ideological sort of subtext to the book. I mean, I think...
Being what? How do you see that subject?
Well, I mean, for example, the book is, and I met him a couple of times, the book is dedicated to Peter Hart, a very controversial historian. Now, I think Peter Hart, you know, he can be criticised, but I think he also did sort of open up new fields. So I've got mixed feelings about him. And indeed, when I was reviewing the book a while ago, He supplied in another context, in other words, not in this book, some of the framework for this book, which is he said that we should have monuments possibly to people like Walter Long, and he could have added Sir John Maxwell and so on as sort of co-founders of this state in the background. And of course, in the decade of centenaries, we are concentrating heavily on the 1912-14 period at the moment. I mean, the genesis of this, I mean, terror didn't just sort of spring out of Minerva's head in 1916.
You're not saying, though, are you, that Peter Hart was partisan, are you? No.
Well, I think he was probably a provocative historian, but I think he made people think deeply. And I can tell you is that I remember a very senior justice official during the peace process reading his I don't have the precise title, but roughly the IRA and terror in its enemies in County Cork, the comment being. Well, they weren't so different now from then. But I do think that, I mean, when you're considering a violence or terror, which I accept that it can be a pejorative term, is the political context is all important, because violence is always savage and inhuman.
But in terms of the title, would you have preferred, in other words, instead of terror in Ireland, political violence in Ireland between...
Last paragraph of the introduction, and he raises the political point, but then David Fitzpatrick shies away from it. Hovering in the background is another question requiring a broader political analysis outside the scope of this book. Could a mutually acceptable Irish settlement have been achieved without the widespread use of terror? Now, my answer to that is, regretfully, no.
Or not unless... other people had behaved in very different ways.
But there was no indication that they were going. And, you know, he asks another question in the introduction. He says, how did the new government, this is the Free State government, the first government of the Irish Free State, how did the new government manage to apply coercion during the Civil War on an unprecedented scale without following the example of its predecessor by losing legitimacy and popular support? Now, I think it's arguable... government, the British government in Ireland, from 1914 on, after the failure of the Home Rule Act, the suspension of the electoral process, no longer has democratic legitimacy. They've given in to violence, or the threat of violence, in the shape of the Ulster Volunteer Force. That threat of violence is so successful, they don't have to fire a shot. And... there's nothing about... And the other thing that isn't mentioned, as far as I can see, anywhere in the book, is the significance of the 1918 election. Because the revolutionary nationalists, if you want to put it like that, they have a democratic mandate. And the British government, they proceed, and Bonar Law, Carson, had the gravest reservations about this. They knew it was going to be a terrible error. They proclaimed Sinn Féin and the Doyle, they proclaim them illegal organisations. Now, whatever about the Doyle, proclaiming Sinn Féin an illegal organisation when most of the people in the country have voted for Sinn Féin, not a word about that anywhere in this book.
So you're not yet, I'm still not clear, but you're not saying the book has a line, are you, Martin, in the sense of...
Well, I think, you know, the merit of the book is in the particular, and many of the studies are... very interesting, but I just share Ronan's reservations about a certain ideological sort of undertow on it, and I think there's always a danger when you.
But my point though is that right through it? Is that through all the essays? And your view?
I just think it's part of the general framework
through the introduction.
Yes. Through the introduction,
and it's certainly it's encapsulated in the title. Now, McGarry, I think, and I would absolve McGarry for
this is who wrote
charges.
Violence in the Easter
That's
Rising. Yeah, why do you
he is a passing
him,
reference to Peter Hart's work, and he says much of the controversy provoked by Hart's work, and he says stems from an ideological conflict about the legitimacy of physical force republicanism, not from scholarly interest in who did what. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that's absolutely right.
Correct, yes.
Yeah.
And that's what at issue here. The real issue here, which is skirted round and touched on and encapsulated in the title, is the legitimacy of physical force republicanism.
And for Fitzpatrick, it has absolutely no legitimacy at all.
He wouldn't put it quite as bluntly as that.
Well, he even asks the question, you know, whether in some ways state terror is more excusable than sort of terror by other organisations.
But the question is, though, the extent to which that colours the other contributions. If assuming the accuracy of your
well,
take
the way I would like to put it is it doesn't destroy the value of the other contributions. I mean, it's a useful and interesting book, and of course, like all good history, it distinguishes legend from history, and there are two good examples of that. I mean, one is the study of the victims of Bloody Sunday. Now, if you believe the Michael Collins film, well, you know, the intelligence elite was wiped out, and this contributed to victory. Of course, there was no victory as such at the time of the truce. And it points out that while some of them were intelligence officers, others were not, and there were sort of cases of mistake. Identity. And similarly, the sort of Kilmichael thing, I think it's very difficult with what one might call small scale battles.
Micro history,
if you like. The same problem arose in relation to Solihull Beg, where even less people were involved. Mm. Disputes about what had happened, whether those who died had been given sort of adequate warning or opportunity to surrender, etc. And I think it is very difficult. I don't think the Kilmichael controversy can be carried much further. I think we have to accept that it's almost impossible to settle definitively what happened, because people who took part, they would have different recollections. No one person probably had an overview of what's happened.
What of Peter Hart's claim that the IRA selected civilians for execution on the basis of their affiliations rather than their actions?
Well, I think
these are the kind of things that I think this happened sometimes.
Yes. Yeah.
I don't think it happens systematically. I don't think it's organized. But this is the kind of thing that happens in a dirty, nasty guerrilla war.
My strong sense, too, is that there are regional variations relating to demography. The experience in, say, South Tipperary would not necessarily have been the same as it would have been in part of Cork. But I do think that there has been a tendency to write history from inverted commas, the victor's point of view. Not that there were victors in a sense, but I mean, should we say, I think if you sat in a pew in a small Church of Ireland church in West Cork, growing vacancies in the pews, the distinction as to whether the people who had gone were unionist, loyalist, spy and informer, or simple, good-hearted Protestant or something would have been lost on one a bit. And I think one of the merits of Peter Hart was that he went and talked to a lot of those sort of families and, if you like, got their side of the story.
You've been critical of David Fitzpatrick for carrying baggage of a kind, but his essay, that's a splendid piece of work, isn't it, on Balbriggan, that sort of detailed examination of the recuperation of damages.
I have no quarrel with that particular one. I mean, which simply illustrates the point, which is well known, is that the TANs or the auxiliaries running amok had a terribly negative, counterproductive effect from the British point of view, and few people would quarrel with that.
So what about that particular essay, Ronan, by David Fitzpatrick on...
Again, I wouldn't have a quarrel. It's the general sort of interpretation. I mean, for example, he also says at one point, he speaks about the code of honour and fair play observed by the rebels of 1916 were rapidly disintegrated as the War of Independence degenerated into a morass of ambushes and assassinations. Now, The War of Independence degenerated into a morass of ambushes and assassinations. Certainly the War of Independence took on the guise of ambushes and assassinations. It did that because the people who were running the war from the Irish side believed that would be effective and it would work.
And
it did.
1916 wasn't effective in a military point of view.
1916.
Your problem really is with the verb degenerate.
Yes, I mean it seemed, yes, absolutely.
Well, I mean, particularly, I mean, the very first incident of the war, 2 miles from my home in Solihull Beg, in a quarry. It's just a nice walk from the house on a sort of a Christmas morning type of thing. If that's how it started out, and of course that was denounced from the pulpit, Canon Arthur Ryan and so on as degenerate.
Escorting
Jellicoe Knight.
Yes.
But you see, I remember interviewing Richard Mulcahy in the early 1970s about the War of Independence. And one of the things he insisted on saying, and it sounds rather bizarre in some ways, but it was the way people like him saw the situation. He insisted that the volunteers, as he called them, which they became increasingly known as the IRA, of course, he insisted the volunteers that it was their role to defend the Doyle, to protect the Doyle, to protect the political process, to protect the results of the 1918 general election in Ireland. Now, that is a fairly skewed view, and I think, you know, ambush, it becomes a much more positive kind of thing. Well, one of the points I would disagree with Martin a bit on is the significance of Bloody Sunday. I mean, there were a few people who weren't intelligence agents, but there's no doubt in my mind about the pivotal effect of Bloody Sunday. Because up until Bloody Sunday, Lloyd George is making these speeches. We have murder by the throat. The reports that are coming on a weekly basis from the police and army commanders in Ireland, just give us another week, we have them on the run, it'll be all over. Bloody Sunday finishes that at a bang. And then a week after that, you have the Kilmichael ambush. And it's very interesting to look at the reaction of Lloyd George and Hamer Greenwood. I just came across a letter, I was doing some research in the Royal Archives, a conversation that Hamer Greenwood, the chief secretary, had with the King's secretary. And his attitude to what happened on Bloody Sunday wasn't quite they deserved what they got, but why in God's name were they going round unarmed? They were intelligence people. Why were they going round unarmed? And he said to the King's secretary, I sleep with a revolver under my pillow every night.
Yeah.
And Lloyd George was equally callous almost, and he said, you know, they got what they deserved. He said they were beaten by counter jumpers, was his phrase.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wasn't in the least intending to deny the impact, particularly the political impact of Bloody Sunday, but I think there is still, an element of myth. See, if you read, say, history,
you say myth in the sense that they have, the people have tended to exaggerate its importance in.
I'm not sure it was the knockout blow, because if you come to the sort of period before the truce, now maybe this is all very self-serving, but the British side felt that militarily speaking they were getting on top of the situation, but then the truce came out of the blue to those who weren't involved in the political side of things.
What about Eunan O'Halpin's point that there's a balance problem for the historian in that there's no, he says, systematic repository of loyalist or British testimony, you know, in the way that you have the Bureau of Military History material.
Well,
on
I think
side.
You see, I think there are people who are now researching the compensation files. Mm-hmm. Now, that's obviously, they have to be treated with caution, as indeed all compensation claims have to be. 1641 et al. But I think there is sort of substantial material, sort of Carson's postback. But I suspect all of that will not give you a completely objective figure, a picture, because there are all the people, shall we say, who were not molested.
Brian Handley makes the point that little work Ronan published on the black and tans in the auxiliaries. That's a little...
I think there's increasingly more work and more research going on at the moment, but relatively speaking, that is
on the question of how... You mentioned Anne Dolan's essay, Ronan, but the burden of her essay is that the personal consequences of terror have been overlooked.
Yes, but I mean, in a certain sense, that's true. But I mean, without wanting to sound too callous about it, I mean, my attitude to that is, so what? I mean, you know, these war is hell. Yeah. And the consequences of guerrilla war are hellish.
Oh, but come on.
No,
I think the agenda is
that there's a general... I'm utterly opposed to violence as a means of achieving political ends. However, I am prepared to say, and this book is not prepared to say, and individual contributions to this book, including the one you've just mentioned, that violence works. I'm not saying it should work, but it does work.
My mother used to say to me, now she was English but married to a historian I worked with, said, don't imagine for a second violence doesn't produce results. Now, of course, it doesn't always produce the results that the people who engage in it, and then you have
that whole area of unintended consequences and so on. Yeah. But that's a different proposition, Ron, to what the one we're talking about. Namely, I get the impression from you that you're rather coldly willing to overlook the personal damage done.
I don't really think it is cold, but I think historians have to, in Yeats's phrase, cast a cold eye on life and death. You have to do that.
You're saying war is war. I mean,
war is hell.
She quotes an example.
Collateral damage in that awful phrase, that obscene phrase. But these things happen.
And it's regardless of whether it's guerrilla war or open war. I mean, lots of people are injured and maimed.
What essay from this will stay with you, Martin, from this collection?
I think probably the Bloody Sunday one, because it went into forensic detail on the individual.
This is by Jane Leonard. Yeah, yes. Is she right in saying, by the way, that it's a more disparate group than heretofore supposed?
Well, I suppose it's been presented in kind of popular legend as an entirely homogenous group, which shows that it isn't. But that isn't to sort of belittle the importance of Bloody Sunday. I mean, Bloody Sunday was hugely important.
But for you, Ronan, a particular
I would agree about Jane Leonard's article. I think it's a fine article. But I think the most impressive one to me is Kilmermichael Revisited by Evan Morrison.
Why?
Because this has occasioned such controversy. And it seems to me that her assessment of this and her analysis of this is dispassionate, it's lucid, and I suspect it's as close to the truth as we're...
I agree with that.
How does she deal, by the way, with Hart?
Well, she says that she wouldn't go along with everything Hart says, but she's quite dispassionate about that, and she certainly would defend him against the worst of the abuse that he's taken from people who regard it as an appalling thing that anybody should impugn the actions of Tom Barry or anybody.
I must say, as you introduced me, I mean, I wouldn't regard myself as a historian on anything like the same level as Ronan Fanning, but I'm a son of a distinguished historian, and I take a keen interest in history and do write some historical commentary. But the demonization of Peter Hart, I must say, it has gone beyond all reasonable lengths. Mm. I mean, I'm not saying in the least that he's above criticism, and I would be critical that he ever used the phrase ethnic cleansing or sort of threw that. Apart from anything else, it's an anachronism in a sense that it's a term that was invented in Yugoslavia in the 1990s.
Well, on that point, I mean, Brian Hanley says that that Hart said there was no ethnic cleansing in the Irish Revolution, but there was ethnically targeted violence.
Yeah, well, you see, I think that was a revision of his of an earlier position of his, where he made the allegation But I mean, the truth obviously is very complicated, and
but you believe he's been demonised? Do you?
Rather yes, than, I yeah. would. I mean, yeah, I think it has. I mean, I think some of the criticism is completely over the top and irrational and over emotional. I think it's the dispassion of Eben Morrison's article that I think is so impressive for a relatively young scholar.
He does mention the contributors, David Fitzpatrick, in his introduction, but surely it needs a separate page outlining, giving details of the contributors.
I agree with you.
You do,
yes.
Yeah.
I do, yeah.
You know, given that you have that mix between professors, graduate students, and undergraduates. Yeah.
You can actually tease it out if you read the paragraphs in Fitzpatrick's introduction.
Yes, well, he does.
That there are, but it would have been helpful if at the end of the book you'd had a list of contributors.
Yeah. Persecuting the Peelers by Brian Hughes, that's a kind of sad chapter, isn't it? The aim, you had the sort of anonymous letters to them. The aim really was to get them to resign. I suppose at one level, in the light of what Roland is saying earlier, it's on the gentler side.
Yeah, you see, one of the things that I think that isn't fully appreciated, and it was brought home to me when I was shown an analytical list of the victims in County Tipperary. By far the two greatest categories of people killed were A, IRA volunteers, and B, RIC men. And of course the RIC men in Tipperary, going by the names, would have been overwhelmingly Catholic. And there is an element, and I don't want to push it stronger than that. I mean, there is an element of civil war almost within the majority community. And I sometimes think today that we almost find it easier, or the nationalist tradition almost finds it easier to reconcile with unionists than it does with, say, the so-called constitutional nationalist Redmondite tradition.
We've been discussing Terror in Ireland, 1916 to 23, edited by David Fitzpatrick, from the proceedings of the Trinity History Workshop of November 2010. My thanks to Roland Fanning and Martin Manser. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie or on the RTE player. Till next week, bye-bye.